talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. Welcome to We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
The return of Jim Batts.
Welcome back, Jim. Today is November the 9th, and we are back here at the Honest Tale Studio. Last week, Kate stood in for Jim. She did a fine job, but we're glad Jim is back. Let's talk about the top 10 box office, because that's what we always do. Let's see. It was Snoopy versus James Bond. Who emerged victorious in the battle of Peanuts versus Spectre, Michelle?
Well, after the past few weekends of movie disappointments, the box office numbers are back on track as 007 and the Peanuts gang saved the weekend's box office. So number one was Sam Mendes' Spectre, brought in $73 million. Rentrak Paul DeCarabedian said, Sony Spectre makes it two consecutive weekends at the top of the global box office chart as it makes its North American debut and enjoys $190 million worldwide weekend performance.
Now, have you heard if that's the biggest Bond opening in the U.S. or
No? I think that's still Skyfall.
Okay.
No. The latest James Bond film holds the number one spot in every market where it's been released across 77 countries. It raked in a phenomenal $117.8 million over 15,000 screens. However, Skyfall debuted to $88.4 million.
Oh, okay.
The movie cost about $100 million to make. So at number two... Yeah,
it was 2.5 hours, though.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, every penny of that looks like it's on screen now, that $100 million. But yeah, 2.5 hours makes for fewer screenings, I guess, during the day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So...
I'm expecting it to do well next weekend as well.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Number two was the Peanuts movie from 20th Century Fox. That came in at $45 million. Audiences, 70% of whom were families, gave the Peanuts movie a strong A cinema score, suggesting that word of mouth will be strong for the animated film. However, also on a side note, the film's opening coincides with the 65th anniversary of the cartoon strip and the 50th anniversary of the annual TV special Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if younger audiences would have that much interest in Peanuts, but I'm glad to be proven wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see it, Jim?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I might try to see it this week.
Dane Marty reviewed it for WeMovieGeeks.com, and he liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that was a great review.
He said it was faithful to the origin strip, which he appreciated.
And it just made the Academy release their 16 animated films, feature films, up for consideration, and it was one of the 16.
That's good crop there, sounds like.
Yeah. Holdovers, The Martian, Goosebumps, and Bridge of Spies round out the top five. The Martian brought in $9.3 million.
What about The Last Witch Hunter?
The Martian has huge potential to win Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Adapted Screenplay for Drew Goddard. It's a really smart film, and audiences have really embraced it. At number four is Goosebumps with $7 million. Bridge of Spies from Disney came in at $6.1 million. The older audiences are driving the box office on this one. It's very nostalgic. So,
yeah, I still think Mark Rylance is a lock for supporting actor for
that. I agree.
Yeah.
At number six is Hotel Transylvania 2 at $3.6 million. At number seven is Burnt, starring Bradley Cooper and Sienna Miller. That's at $3 million. At number eight is The Last Witch Hunter.
Oh, my gosh.
$2.6 million from Lionsgate.
I'm surprised still in the top 10, aren't you?
Yeah.
Number nine was The Intern at $1.8 million. And at number 10 is Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension at $1.6 million. Number 11, Our Brand is Crisis with a paltry $1.5 million.
Yeah.
And the faith-based Woodlawn came in at $1.2 million.
Yeah, listen to last week's podcast, and I remember Kate seeming to think that that word of mouth would help out Brand, but it sounds like it's not kicking in yet.
Negative word of mouth really never helps anything.
Well, she was thinking it was going to be positive.
I don't think so. So what's opens Friday? My All-American? Anything else big open Friday?
My All-American and The 33.
No, those aren't gonna knock 007.
Oh, no.
I don't think so. Also, the smaller movies that we have reviewed. The new opener, Miss You Already, starring Drew Barrymore and Toni Collette, opened in 384 theaters, one being St. Louis. to 572,000, which, I mean, for that kind of movie is good.
Kate gave that a positive review.
Yeah.
I did see that. I had some issues with her review. I thought that the Toni Collette character is such a jerk an hour into it that it just, you know, you want to get back on her sympathetic side because she's sick.
You're glad she gets cancer.
Well, not really. Meh. But, you know, it's like, I never quite bought the relationship between the two women. I think that Drew Barrymore's character kind of gets shortchanged. Mm-hmm. And they give the guys a little something to do, but not too much. They're just kind of in the periphery. Dominic Cooper plays Toni Collette's hubby, and Patty Considine is Drew Barrymore's hubby in that. And they do what they can with it, but a lot of it's kind of cloying and precious.
Three other possible award contenders also made their debut in limited release: Spotlight, Brooklyn, and Trumbo. Spotlight, from director Tom McCarthy, was the strongest of the pack, opening to 302,000 with only 5 theaters. Brooklyn, the 1950s set immigrant story from Fox Searchlight, took in a respectable 181,000 from 5 theaters. The early Oscar buzz on this and the excitement is starting to build, especially for with the strong female lead from
Saoirse Ronan.
This could be a possible watch out for the Best Picture. The Academy likes this kind of a movie.
I could see her getting a Best Actress nomination. Maybe,
and the picture.
Before we started, we were referring to the great article in Entertainment Weekly about the Best Actress race, and it is jam-packed this year.
Last year it was Best Actor, and Best Actress was much weaker, so they gave Julianne Moore kind of the Gold Watch trophy. And it's shaping up this year. I would say that Matt Damon's kind of got the inside track, don't you think? Especially with Steve Jobs sort of bombing.
Some are saying Leo DiCaprio. He's kind of due Revenant. After 22 years.
I'm still hoping they'll remember Ian McKellen as Mr. Holmes Best Actor.
I think they will for the nomination.
The screeners just went out for that. Hopefully they will. Yeah, I think Brooklyn is definitely a possibility for Best Picture and Screenplay. Miss Ronan is very good in it. Yeah,
Trumbo, starring Bryan Cranston, took in 77,000 in only 5 theaters. So these three pictures will be helped by good word of mouth. Overall, things are looking up at the box office. The final installment of the Hunger Games franchise opens in 2 weeks, and Star Wars The Force Awakens bows in just over 2 months. And we have posted the new international trailer, which people like went nuts over on Friday.
You talk about the Asian one there that has
the one
bunch
from
of
Japan.
A lot of footage that's not been seen. Yeah.
Exactly. No Mark Hamill yet.
No.
And the first TV spot aired on Sunday.
Oh, the first TV spot aired yesterday or next Sunday?
This Sunday.
This coming
so
Sunday,
we've posted both of them. Kathleen Kennedy was over at, who's the producer and running Lucasfilm now. Mm-hmm. She was over at Japan D23. So the big Disney Expo was was in Japan this weekend. And they, on Friday, premiered the new international trailer and people flipped.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. So those films, Spotlight, Brooklyn, and Trumbo. Each were just in 5 theaters this past weekend.
Is Trumbo a remake of the Disney movie about the flying elephant?
You know better than that, Tom.
Trumbo looks really entertaining.
Well, that was Dumbo.
Yeah.
Well, at least Dumbo wasn't a proud commie. All right, let's start reviewing some of these movies. Let's start with 007 Spectre.
Tell me where he is.
He's everywhere.
You should go there. You're crossing over to a place where there is no mercy.
Michael Hafner reviewed it for We Are Movie Geeks. So what do you give it, 3 out of 5?
Yeah.
How can you give a James Bond movie
not,
3 out of 5?
Have you seen Rotten Tomatoes? It's not...
Is it in the 80s in Rotten Tomatoes? Yeah, or the 60s?
I think it's like 62.
62?
Yeah.
Yeah,
hell, I'd give a Moonraker more than 3 stars.
No, I would not.
You got to kind of judge it within the context of other Bond movies. Sure, it's not as good as Skyfall. It's not as good as Casino Royale. But those are 5-star movies. I think Spectre is probably about the same level as Quantum of Solace, which is about a 4.5-star.
I would say it's better than Quantum of Solace. Solace is still the weakest of the Craig ones, I think. Yeah, I'm surprised it's not doing a little bit better with the critics, but I think they're having. Are we going to get into the review here? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
how,
yeah.
I'm not how much of the plot we should get into.
Well, I thought it had a great plot.
Actually. Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know what I don't want to give away a lot of spoilers.
We can allude to some of the twists.
At 73 million, I think everybody saw it.
It was kind of critic proof, right?
Yeah. But no, I did have a problem with the plot. It just kind of meandered, and there's a sidetrack to this desolated cabin that I never quite understood kind of what was going on besides him getting clues. I read somebody on Facebook was comparing Bond to Dora the Explorer. I guess Carmen Sandiego might be more appropriate because they just wanted to make sure they get in as many exotic and far away locations. Now I'm in Austria. Now I'm in Mexico.
They always do
now,
that, though.
But it just didn't seem like that the plot was propelling them enough to warrant all that.
I thought it had a great plot. I thought it had a whole lot of momentum.
I don't know. Maybe I'm getting a little fatigued with all the spy stuff this year. Maybe with the Kingsman and Uncle and Another Mission Impossible, it's tough to keep up with the new kids on the block.
I found it interesting that they went back to a snow landscape. It's been since 2002, Die Another Day, and they've had six previous adventures amid snowbound locales.
Yeah, I thought that Dave Bautista was terrific as sort of the secondary villain.
I did too. I thought he was a real...
He was kind of a throwback to Odd Job, or even more so Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love.
Well, especially with the second best action scene in it is the fight on the train.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's just tossing, he just looks so much bigger than Daniel Craig. Yeah. He's tossing him around like a rag doll or something.
You think he'll be back? I mean, his exit from the film was a little vague. It certainly wasn't a satisfying demise to any extent. I think they're going to bring him back.
It wasn't like he took a grenade to the face or something.
No. I thought the car chases were breathtaking. I mean, he's Bond's in his usual Aston Martin, but boy, they put Dave Bautista in a Jaguar. Oh, that was a great
built it around him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was
the
a great
Mexico
car
City,
chase.
You know, that sequence with the helicopter,
the
that
opening,
was out of control. That was amazing.
Yeah, that was my favorite sequence, was the opening sequence. Some people were complaining online and says, why do they do the best sequence at the start of the film? And I was like, well, sometimes they can, it works out that way, kind of.
Yeah. But, one of my problems with the film was the glamour element, or I should say lack thereof. There weren't the glamour girls in every corner of, like there should be in a Bond film. It starts out with there's a Latino woman that he beds, but he abandons her pretty quickly. Monica Bellucci, who I expected to be, the Bond girl, has a very brief scene, and then she never comes back. She's kind of this damsel in distress, and they never really pick up on her story again.
Well,
she's kind of
away from that recently.
Well, she's kind of fulfilling the standard Bond girl that was, I guess, started with Shirley Eaton in Goldfinger, the fabulous gal that Bond meets in the first half hour, and then usually,
usually they kill him off.
Yeah,
though.
Usually, yeah. But we assume that she survives. Although there's a concentrated effort to off her right before Bond meets her.
Sure, but then Leah Seydoux.
Yeah,
I thought she was kind of bland and a little she sort of dressed modestly.
That outfit on the train, though.
Yeah,
that is something. Somebody posted a frame blow up from that on Facebook, and everyone was going, wow.
Yeah, well, I think Monica Bellucci was much sexier than Leah Seydoux.
But, the glamour element wasn't that evident in Skyfall. There was only, I believe, the actress's name,
that's
Berenice
Marlowe. They're trying to steer away from that.
The Bond girl in Skyfall was actually Judi Dench's the one that's kind of with him towards the end.
But there was cocktail waitresses, and there were scenes by pools with women in bikinis. There just wasn't any of that.
You're talking about eye candy, characters.
They said they're trying to. This is the first Bond film ever to visit Rome. Also, I noticed that. What'd you guys think of the song from Sam Smith? Writings on the Wall.
I don't remember it. Yeah, it's not. It doesn't have the hook that Adele's song had last.
And she won the Oscar. So. I did appreciate Thomas Newman's score. I mean, he did Bridge of Spies, and I always like, I always like the score he puts on his films.
Yeah, I did like the graphics for the opening, use of the tentacles and everything. That was very interesting. That was very creative. Yeah.
A lot of references to other Bond films, more so than ever. And they sort of gave Bond this backstory, and they delved into his childhood. I think that was a little unnecessary and a little arbitrary.
Well, they're really concentrating, trying to hook, to connect all the Craig Bonds together. And with the Bond films over the years, there's been very little connection from film to film.
Right.
Jaws appeared in two films, actually. In
The Redneck Sheriff.
And The Redneck Sheriff, Eunice Gayson. Here's a trivia question there. The first Bond girl, really, she appears in both Dr. No and From Russia with Love in the opening sequence. Besides that, Diamonds Are Forever opens with Sean Connery's Bond tracking down Blofeld after he's killed his wife from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and that's referenced again in For Your Eyes Only.
Mm-hmm.
But generally in the older films, besides the trio of Q, M, and Moneypenny, there's really very little connection. It's just another James Bond adventure.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think they need a backstory of James Bond, an origin story. Save the origin story for the Marvel universe.
There was an article I read over the weekend that is it time to wrap up the Bond series?
Is it time to finish
the franchise?
No.
Okay, and the front runner right now, the gossip mill has Idris Elba as the next James Bond.
That's not going to happen.
Well,
my prediction.
I don't know. Yeah, that was another problem I had with Spectre. Was Daniel Craig seemed a little bored.
His interviews, he was so done. Have you read some of the interviews?
Yeah, I know. I keep on reading. He's committed contractually to another Bond, but I would hope that they could get go out on a better note, his Bond, than Spectre. I'd hate to see Spectre to be his last turn as Bond.
Because that's what's being reported. This is his farewell.
Well, I guess it depends on if they can lure Sam Mendes again, who I guess is his guy, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't think the film is, or this film series has run out of steam. But it would be interesting to see who they would.
It's too much of a cash cow. They're going to keep making the Bond movies.
Oh yeah.
Long after we're gone.
yeah, it's just amazing. It's over 50 years now. It seems just to keep getting bigger and bigger, although it's had its highs and lows over the years, that's for certain.
Maybe we'll talk about that a little later. The highs and the lows of
007.
There you go. A couple of movies opened this weekend, including Love the Coopers.
This is Charlotte Cooper.
Merry Christmas, everyone!
She has one simple holiday wish.
This is the only time of the year when we're all together. I want everyone to have the memory of a perfect Christmas. Next up.
To see the one, the only... Santa! Yay! And Santa's army of helpers.
Really?
Jim and I saw Love the Coopers, three or four weeks ago, and we've been biting our tongues under orders ever since. Love the Coopers is actually going to make probably my top 10 list. Top 10 worst movies of 2015. Man. What a dog.
Oh, my gosh. What a load of sour eggnog.
Yeah.
And it's spoiled, buddy.
Yeah, and speaking of dogs, it's narrated from beginning to end. It's this family gathers at Christmas drama. So it's narrated by Steve Martin, and you're wondering who this character is because he doesn't identify himself, and I'm going to give away the ending. Turns out it's the family dog, which doesn't make any sense because the family dog doesn't leave the house. He doesn't know what's going on in these characters' minds.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what happened to him.
He's not in a patrol car.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I know, at the airport. But Steve Martin being the narrator. Now, I hate to brag a little bit, but I was able to recognize his voice right away. So all during it, I'm thinking, Steve, why are you doing this? You made a wonderful holiday movie. You made a holiday movie that you could watch any day of the year.
Yeah.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is one of the greatest holiday films of all time. And what are you doing in this dreck?
From the director of I Am Sam and Corinna.
I Am Sam. Was that the one with Sean Penn?
Yes,
where he was
throwing it out there. Just saying.
Well, it's got Diane Keaton and John Goodman, and they're the matriarchs. And then Alan Alda is her father, and then they have
Alan Alda is 12 years older than Diane Keaton.
Yeah, I think Diane Keaton's probably about 8 years older than John Goodman.
Six, actually. Yeah.
And who's their kids? Marissa Tomei? Yep.
Well, Olivia Marissa Wilde. Tomei is Diane Keaton's sister.
Oh, is her sister?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's been a while since I saw
it. You're trying to drive it out of your mind.
Who else?
Their daughter is Olivia Wilde.
Yeah,
their son is Ed Helms.
And then the other daughter. Amanda Seyfried?
Amanda Seyfried's not their daughter. Amanda Seyfried? Oh, boy.
Maybe I wasn't paying attention. I've tried to block this movie out of my mind.
You're trying to go to your happy place, and that would be anywhere that's not showing Love the Coopers.
Yeah.
But no, Amanda Seyfried is the waitress that Alan Arkin sort of befriends every morning at the diner.
And brings her over to the family for Christmas because she's depressive or something.
Yeah. We have to have that quick shot of her wrist and see a scar there so we can go, oh my gosh, she's hurting inside and all this.
It's so sappy and so precious and so poorly written and so poorly acted. Diane Keaton just shrieks all of her lines.
And that subplot, we mentioned Marissa Tomei. There are three Oscar winners in this thing.
I'm surprised. It opens this weekend.
I hated that subplot you're talking about. It didn't make any sense. She's a shoplifting suspect, so Anthony Mackie picks her up in the patrol car and drives her around for the whole movie. I mean, it takes place in Pittsburgh. Is that what the Pittsburgh police is going to do as far as resources? Is send this cop in there like a substation closer to the mall that they could have used? But then they have to have this conversation, and she gives all these platitudinous lectures about her life and how it relates to his sexuality, and it's just awful. I was embarrassed for Mr. Mackie.
Yeah, this is the second closeted character he's played, and I was like, come on. Man, you know, he did that in I think it was What's Your Number, which is actually better than this. Yeah. But, this is just so precious. They have, horrible. With the narration, they show little flash forwards or sort of fantasy sequence. You get the shot of someone, being embarrassed and turning into ice and exploding. I think they did that.
No, she's shattered. That's what shattered, that true shattered. So she turns into glass and it shatters.
They did that
several times.
Like, dozens of years ago. They didn't do that on Ally McBeal.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of some bad TV show.
It's just dreadful.
The screenwriter also wrote PSA Love You from 2007, Kate and Leopold, Hope Floats, and Stepmom.
Quite a record there.
The Ed Helms character doesn't have much to do in it. No. He's trying to hide the fact that he's looking for work. And then
you got June Squibb, and you got a bunch of jokes at her expense because she's old, and she farts, and it's just embarrassing.
It says the inappropriate things, and she's a... Adorable.
Oh, this is a shame. This is a darn shame.
After I mentioned it when we were setting up after the screening, some of the reviewers were going to give it a pass because it's Christmassy and it's full of decorations and all that. Mm. If you want to go experience decorations, just go to your mall, go to the Santa Land, go drive around and watch the houses. Don't waste your time with this.
Yeah, or if you want to see a good Christmas movie, go see It's a Wonderful Life when it plays at the High Point next month, or go rent a much better Christmas movie. There's plenty out there. Vacation, Christmas Story, a gazillion of them. Anything's better than Love the Coopers. Even the title, I hate. I hate everything about this movie.
We didn't delve into the subplot with Olivia Wilde when she's cavorting with Jake Lacy.
And he plays a soldier she meets at the airport, and she takes him home and tells everybody that she's engaged to this guy. Actually, Jake Lacy, I think, acquits himself well. He escapes this film with his dignity intact. He's actually
just
pretty good.
Barely.
And I saw him off the subject. But I saw Carol yesterday, which is going to be an Oscar contender with Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And Jake Lacy's in that and has quite a big role. And he's really, really good in that. So I think he's an actor to look for, despite Love the Coopers.
Yeah. Another office expat there, along with Ed Helms. But they even do a sequence of them cavorting and laughing and giggling, running around the airport. And you're like, gag me, for goodness sake.
I think security would have tackled him.
Oh, and the subplot with Ed Helms' kids with the one, trying to, kiss this girl. It's just ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Just terrible.
And, of course, he's got a little girl that's 5 or 6 that says a bad word. Everyone is kind of trying to hold back the laughter. I just can't stand this film.
So we don't love the Coopers. We hate the Coopers. We hate their family.
Well, we love the actors.
We like most of the actors.
Sure.
They signed on to this, they need to fire their agents, I believe.
Should have known better.
Yeah, all right. So we don't recommend Love the Coopers. Who's reviewing that? Are you reviewing that?
I might be.
Okay, lucky. All right, and Jim also saw The 33.
A serious accident just occurred at the San Jose mine.
That's a big rock.
That's not a rock. That's the heart of the mountain. She finally broke.
And
33 men trapped underground.
And we don't even know if they're alive.
We all know how this goes. The government tells us how much they care, and they do nothing.
Which opens Friday.
Yeah,
how's the 33, Jim?
33, looking forward to that.
33 is pretty good, pretty good. I think it's kind of getting some mixed word of mouth about it, but it's got some strong performances, especially Antonio Banderas. I think it's going to take a lot of heat because a lot of Anglo actors are playing South Americans and Latin characters. Mm-hmm. Right. Gabriel Byrne is playing Irishman, is playing one.
Adam Sandler, is he in it doing?
No. Juliette Binoche has a major role in it.
Yes.
She's French, isn't she?
And yeah,
she's mm-hmm. playing a Chilean, but yeah, it's okay. I think it could have easily been a TV movie, a drama of the week, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it
right.
elevates itself above that. Actually, mm-hmm. we're talking about people from the old TV show The Offers. Oscar Nunez is in it, who played Oscar on the old show,
and he's a Latino.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. He on the Office, he was playing the pretty much the only gay character in the Office, and in this film, he's playing the womanizer. He's the fella that not only has his wife, but has his mistress waiting for him to come out of the mine.
He's trying to make up for that Office thing.
Yes.
Although wasn't Angela on the Office married to a gay senator or something?
Yeah, that was true. But we digress.
But back to the
Chilean mine. Yeah. The actual collapse of the mountain mm-hmm. is done sort of subtly. It's not a big special effects moment. You really feel like you're down there with the fellas. They have a little more space than I thought they're in. They were able to make it to, I think they call it the ready room, the sort of conference area that's sort of at the midpoint as you're driving back up through the tunnels. And so they have a little more space, but they show you how, it was very hot in there. Mm-hmm. It was like mm-hmm. 100 degrees. And they really show you the struggle they had with the food. They did have some supplies there, but they were just a few cans of tuna fish and a couple of bags of cookies. And the guys are really in desperate straits. But it does account for my favorite scene in the film, in which they're eating what they believe will be their last meal. They're going to mm-hmm. Completely run out. Mm-hmm. And they all of a sudden imagine that the little plastic cup with a few ounces of tuna fish is a fabulous feast prepared by their loved ones. And that's a sweet moment.
Okay, and it's rated PG, so I guess they're trying to push it towards a family audience.
Yeah. It's uplifting.
Nothing offensive in it.
Got the old the people all waiting outside, and Lou Diamond Phillips is in it, playing
yes.
one of the miners trapped in there. It's nice to see him back in a feature film there.
It's also from woman director Patricia Riggin, who did 2007's Under the Moon.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Under the Same Moon. Excuse me.
Under the Same Moon, yeah. And Lou Diamond is the fellow that's sort of in the role of the guy that tries to warn mm-hmm. everybody what's going to happen. Of course, everything he warns about does go ahead and happen, but it's really well done, and it's good. It's okay. Yeah.
And it's one of James Horner's final scores.
It is dedicated to him at the end of it, so that was a nice touch too.
All right, so Jim does recommend The 33, which opens this Friday. Also opening this Friday is My All-American.
I'm offering you a scholarship to attend the University of Texas and play football.
Well, every other coach has thought I was too small to play.
I like the way you attack.
You will not regret giving me the chance, sir.
Give me my hand back now, son.
Sorry.
And that stars Aaron Eckhart. I think it's about
a
true story about a college football player. And he's little, so he doesn't play. Sounds like, was that Rudy from a few years ago?
It is. It's by the same author who did Hoosiers, and it's set at the University of Texas.
Look for a review of that Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, as well as reviews of Love the Cooper and the 33. On the phone, we have Melissa Thompson calling from L.A. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Very good, thanks. Melissa is attending the AFA conference, and they will be showing 33 this evening. Melissa, Jim liked the 33. You excited about it?
Yeah, actually, I am. I thought it was such a great human interest story at the time, and the whole world watched it on TV as it happened. So I'm actually surprised it took them this long to make a feature film about it. But, yeah, I'm really excited to see it. I think it's going to be really good.
And tell us about this AFI thing that you've been attending.
It's the yearly festival for the American Film Institute. They usually have a lot of big gala screenings, like the 33. Last night I saw Queen of the Desert, the Werner Herzog movie starring Nicole Kidman, which is amazing.
It's good? What's that about?
It's about this woman named Gertrude Bell. She was a British subject in the late 1800s and sort of a society girl, but very smart, and she wanted to have an adventure and get away. So she went into the Arabian Desert, and as a poet and a traveler, and just got to know all of the Bedouins and the tribes that were living out there, and they accepted her very well. And then when it came time for Winston Churchill and the British Empire to start carving up that part of the world for them, she came in very handy because she knew all of them and they all trusted her. And so what today is Iraq, Iran, and Jordan, back then was Persia, and that's when it was being all carved up for the various colonies.
What was the name of that film again?
It's called Queen of the Desert.
Queen of the Desert. Okay.
Yeah, it's a true story. Like I said, her name is Gertrude Bell, and that's what they called her. The Bedouins called her that because she was such a wonderful diplomat, and she knew all the tribes, and she loved them, and they loved her. Mm-hmm. So when politics started getting involved, they went to her because she was very trusted among them.
Okay. What other films would you like to talk about from AFI?
Well, the next big one coming up, I think, tomorrow night is Concussion with Will Smith.
Oh, yeah.
About the doctor who was like the whistleblower of the NFL. About the head injuries that are, you know, directly related and blamed on all the hard hitting, even though they wear helmets and pads. You know, all these former football players that now have brain injuries that have lasted their entire lives because of that. So Will Smith, it's the true story also. So Will Smith plays the doctor who sort of discovered all this and threatened to go public. And then the NFL was not too happy about that, as you can imagine.
Another film showing at AFI, Melissa, is The Big Short. What can you tell us about The Big Short?
Oh, yeah, that's the closing night gala, and that's actually really, really good. I've seen that, and it's really something amazing. It's got all these great people in it. It's an ensemble, and it's about the whole when the housing bubble burst in 2008 and the Wall Street banks were, you know, blinded to the fact that this was going to happen, and they acted like something was wrong, and these hedge fund managers all realized it was going to happen, so they sort of tried to beat him to the punch. Like I said, it's an ensemble, but there's all these great big names in it, like Brad Pitt's in it and Steve Carell, but they all have just small sort of supporting parts, and it's really, really, really good. I liked it a lot.
Melissa, is more of a comedy, or is it really a dramatic film?
You know, it's a little bit of both. It's really hilarious. Ryan Gosling sort of serves as the narrator, but he's a character in it. So a lot of times he's literally stopping and looking into the camera and speaking to the audience, kind of keeping us up to speed with what's going on, because it's all very complicated. Unless you're in banking and Wall Street, all the terms they're using, it's not sort of easy to follow. So it was smart to put a narrator sort of to kind of guide you along. And it's very funny, and then there's parts of it that aren't so funny. So it's almost perfect.
How was Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie Pitt's
Beyond the Sea?
Yeah, how did that go over?
Yeah, you know, that was the opening night gala for AFI, and they were really expecting a lot out of it because it's them. It's they're both A-list, and she's writing and directing, and she wrote this a few years ago, and they decided to get it made, and obviously with the two of their big names, there was no problem getting it made. But the reviews weren't that great. They said it was beautifully shot. It looked wonderful. The story kind of dragged. There were long periods of, like, minutes and minutes would go by of just them, like, walking or sitting in a room. Like, so it really kind of, from what I heard, it dragged a lot, and it just wasn't, I guess, what everyone was hoping it would be.
The trailer drags.
I mean, we'll see what audiences think of it when it gets released, you know?
Okay. Let me ask you one thing real quick. What's your favorite James Bond movie?
Oh, gosh. I'm not really up with the current one, so I'd have to go back to an old one, like Spy Who Loved Me.
There you go. All right.
Like that.
We're just taking a poll.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm not up on the current ones. I know there's a new one out or coming out.
Yeah, we just reviewed it.
Oh, okay.
It's good. Well, you should see it.
Oh, good. Yeah, but, you know, AFI's been good this year. It's a big festival. There's a lot of crowds, big turnout, all the galas. Like, you know, to get tickets, you have to sort of do a standby line. Last night, there were probably 500 people in line for the Nicole Kidman movie. And they show it in all the different theaters up and down Hollywood Boulevard, so you can easily walk from one to the other. And so it's gone over pretty well this year. It's still going on. It ends this coming Thursday, the 12th. So there's still a lot of movies to be seen and a lot of good things going on. It's a good festival. I like it. I always go.
Well, let's see. Now, one other thing. You're Michelle's sister, right?
I am.
Now, which one of you does your mom like the most?
Oh, probably her. You know, the oldest.
Okay, well, good. Well, thanks a lot for calling in.
Thanks for having me. It was good to talk to you guys.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Melissa will be filing a comprehensive report on AFI, everything, you know, once it ends.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Melissa will be filing a lawsuit for me asking about
the Smothers Sisters.
Melissa said her favorite 007 movie is The Spy Who Loved Me. That's a good one, though.
Yeah, that's one of Moore's better ones. I don't think it's his best, but it's one of the better Moore's.
It's just entertaining.
It's a good one. It's got some beautiful Bond women. You got Caroline Monroe in that one. You've got Barbara Bach. You've got Madeline Smith and Valerie Leon, who are a couple of Hammer starlets in some small roles.
Yeah. Barbara Bach's character in it. She's kind of the female equivalent of 007, the Russian equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I like that one. Although I would say my favorite 007 of all time is On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
The new Bond.
Suppose I were to kill you for a thrill.
The different 007.
Oh. Yeah, a friend of ours says that's not only his favorite Bond, but his favorite film of all time.
Christopher Nolan, the director, says that's his favorite film of all time.
Yeah.
And that's the one where, of course, Sean Connery had left the series. So they sunk more money into it, and the action sequences were bigger and better, and they hired this guy named George Lazenby, who actually is really, really good as Bond. And I'm not sure if this rumor's true or not, but did he turn down the opportunity to play Bond again?
I think that's what he says, but I wonder if it's one of those, you know, different opinions and, you know, different points of view type of things.
Perhaps, but his career went absolutely nowhere. He's still around. He should do autograph shows. I think he'd do well.
But
that's an amazing movie. And Diana Rigg is one of the great Bond girls.
Yes.
Kelly Savalas as Blofeld. It was amazing.
Talk about the ice sequences in Spectre. Boy, you can't beat the ones in the toboggan chase. Honor Majesty's Secret Service. That's for certain. And a lot of the Bond aficionados say if Sean had the lead in that, Connery had been in that, that everyone would consider it hands down the best Bond film of all time.
It would be off the charts. And Connery came back and did Diamonds Are Forever after that, which was so inferior.
Oh, it's his weakest Bond. I would say I think his sort of non-official Bond, Never Say Never, is better than Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, really. Diamonds Are Forever was the first 007 I saw at the theater. I guess I would have been about 9, and I haven't missed one since. What's your favorite 007 movie, Jim?
I have to say, go with one of the Golden Agers, Goldfinger.
Goldfinger, a triumph in thrill-making cinema entertainment.
The man with the mind.
A three-time winner for Fleming's Secret Agent 007.
Who are you?
My name is Pussy Galore.
I think the Honor Blackman is just unforgettable as Pussy Galore. But it's got the coolest Bond theme song ever by Shirley Bassey, who belted it a few years ago.
No. Tom Jones' Thunderball is the best James Bond theme.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree, but Thunderball is pretty great, too. Mm. But it's got such an interesting plot. You know, this fellow wants to increase the value of his own gold supply, so he's going to drop an atom bomb on Fort Knox. It's just crazy, and it's entertaining. I think it might have been it was the first time they brought James Bond's character to America, so that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. He's sort of squirreled away in Kentucky through most of the film. Yeah, it's got just some terrific sequences, and it introduces the greatest Bond gadget of them all, perhaps the Aston Martin. I remember seeing this at an early Chicago Comic Con in the evenings after the dealer's room had shut down. They would show movies in the big auditorium, and they show Goldfinger, and Q introducing the Aston Martin gets a huge thunderous round of applause at that screen because they love that car.
Yeah, I'd say Goldfinger and Thunderball is when they really started merchandising Bond. I think the first couple were sort of more serious Cold War thrillers. And then they became big and fun, and I think kids maybe sort of got turned on to them. So then you got all the Goldfinger board games and jigsaw puzzles and action figures and corgi toys.
The Aurora figures. They put out the Aurora model kits of Lunchbox. Bond and Oddjob.
Yeah, that's right. I have them.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I also have the lunchbox, which actually I think has a Thunderball on one side and Goldfinger on the other. What's your favorite? Mm-hmm. So far, we've got a vote for Spy Who Loves Me, a vote for Her Majesty's Secret Service, or vote for Goldfinger. Yeah. And what does...
Michelle, you can redeem yourself from last podcast.
I went back and looked. I mean, I really like You Only Live Twice. I like Thunderball. I mean, I really love From Russia With Love.
But you got to narrow it down to one.
I would say From Russia With Love.
There you go.
Yeah, it's interesting. When the Bond films finally started hitting home video, I guess VHS and maybe the mid-80s, it gave a lot of us a chance to revisit them. I remember my buddy from college was really into Goldfinger, so he had to rent that right away. And when we brought it back to the video store, he said, well, you haven't watched From Russia With Love in a long time. And so we rented that, and it's like, this is really good. I'd forgotten how good that is.
Yeah.
I think she's changing her mind. My top five would be You Only Live Twice. I mean, Roald Dahl wrote the screenplay for that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a great John Barry score.
Yeah, a lot of that is kind of parodied in the Austin Powers film, especially Donald Pleasance's as Blofeld. But the whole, you know, secret lair inside of a volcano idea is kind of starts in that film.
Although some Austin Powers costumes, I think, were a spoof of On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Sure, with the mascot. With the big fluffy shirts and all that. Yeah.
All right, so those are our favorites. Spectre is not our favorite, but we still like Spectre. We are still in the middle of the St. Louis International Film Festival. Yesterday, I saw Carol. Carol is Todd Haynes' new film.
How many times have you been in love?
You're always the most beautiful woman in the room.
Therese Balavet.
Carol.
Tell me you know what you're doing.
I never did.
One of the big showcase films at the St. Louis International Film Festival that stars Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. That's really good. We'll probably do a more detailed review later on because it doesn't open until December 20th in St. Louis. But it's about forbidden lesbian love in the early 1950s. A lot of Todd Haynes movies seem to be about acceptance of homosexuality in a different time period. Far From Heaven and Velvet Goldmine and Poison and a couple of others. It's really a good movie, and it's getting a lot of acclaim for its acting by both Miss Mara and Miss Blanchett. I think they're probably both be up for Oscars.
Now, Tom, do you think that it's really Rooney Mara's the lead, or is it Cate Blanchett?
Well, it's sort of told through Rooney Mara's eyes, but I think her part is smaller ultimately. So I think they'll if they split it up, they'll put her in supporting and Miss Blanchett in lead, or they might put them both in lead.
No, they're going to do it the opposite, because Rooney Mara also, she co-won the Cannes Film Festival for Best Actress earlier in May.
It's hard to say.
Yeah, EW was seeming to think that they were going to put Rooney in supporting, but thinking they're going to switch that again. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. But you know who else is good is this actor. Jake Lacy, I mentioned, he was really good. Uh-huh. He actually plays Rooney Mara's boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
His frustrated boyfriend, I should add. Kyle Chandler is really, really good as Cate Blanchett's angry husband. So, you know, let's not ignore these actors that are in this women's film because they're, you know, you got to have good actors.
Yeah, Kyle is mostly known as a TV star. He had a nice role in The Spectacular Now, but this might be his kind of breakthrough in a major film role.
Well, Super 8, he was kind of the star of that as well.
Yeah,
yeah. He was good in that. So that showed at the St. Louis International Film Festival, as did The 33, and Love the Coopers actually played at the St. International Film Festival.
I'm really impressed that Carol, because it opens in limited release November 20th. Huh. So for it to open at SLIF is, that's pretty impressive.
That's a coup for them. Yeah. That's a big one. Plus they have that, I'm going to mispronounce it, that Alamosa, the R-rated animated film from the mind of Charlie Kaufman.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of a big get for them, I think. Yeah,
that'll be pretty good. Jim and I are both judges. Jim's judging, I guess, 8 or 9 narrative features, and I'm judging 8 documentary features. Jim, have you watched all the narrative features? I know tonight's Band of Robbers, that was one of the ones you had to watch.
That was one of the ones. What'd that was the that only one? English language one.
You don't know me unless you know about me and Tom Sawyer. Where we've been, what we've done together. After so many years of chasing a fairy tale, most people would be ready to give up. Tom Sawyer isn't most people.
Well, I'm not quite as enthusiastic as you about it. I think the idea is very clever of bringing Huck and Tom Sawyer into the 21st century and making them these sort of burnt out 20-somethings. I don't know. I may have had a problem with the Tom Sawyer character. He's such a boob in it that you wonder how he could ever have been made a police officer.
Yeah.
He's kind of running around frantic at the end of it. He's paired up with Melissa Benoist, who is sort of the it girl right now after the Supergirl TV series premiered a couple weeks ago. She doesn't have a whole lot to do in it. They might be trying to sell, her film when it gets released eventually.
I don't blame them.
But you're right, Stephen Lang is very entertaining. Yeah. And what's very funny about that is his defense of being called an Injun Joe.
Yeah. He's not really an Indian. And he goes, so it's not racist to want to be another race,
is it? Yes, it's sort of my kind of tribute
running,
to this.
It's kind of a running joke. Yeah,
that's kind of funny. But at the end of it, it just seems like it's a Raising Arizona wannabe.
Mm-hmm.
It's everyone running around frantic and guns firing and a lot of people having to think of excuses and confuse folks. And it's not one of my, favorites of the narrative films.
Yeah, you can read my interview with the co-directors, the Brothers Knee at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I had to watch about 8 of these documentaries, and there's a pretty good one called In My Father's House about a rap star whose name escapes me, who tracks down his father, who he's sort of estranged from, and his father's kind of a alcoholic and unemployed, and he helps him get back on his feet. That one was kind of nice. I also saw one called The Champions, which was about Michael Vick and the dogs that he used for his dogfighting ring, and they follow these 6 dogs as they're adopted by some 6 families, and that's pretty good, although it gets a little redundant. It seems like all 6 stories are pretty much the same. Tell me about a couple of the other narratives you saw, Jim.
Oh, I wanted to check the schedule and make sure it was still playing. I think my favorite of the narratives is playing for the last time this evening over at Plaza Frontenac, and that is Embrace of the Serpent.
Oh, yeah.
And it's from several different countries down in South America. It's all set around the Amazon in 2 different time frames. It's about this shaman, this sort of medicine man who's the last of his tribe, and how he befriended a couple of foreign explorer scientists once in 1909 and again in 1940. And so it's jumping between the 2 timelines with 2 different actors playing this native. And what's interesting, it's all the jungle, foliage and, plants and all that, but it's shot in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks gorgeous. It's sort of got a silver sheen to it. And it's really interesting, especially later on when you see an incident that occurs in 1909 and this repercussions in 1940. It's kind of, you're drifting along in the canoe and there's some dangerous tribes that they encounter, and it's really interesting, it's kind of leisurely paced, but it feels like you're on the river with these people, and I think it's very interesting. Also coming up is a nice little film called Thebe from Theeb from United Arab Emirates, and it's all set in 1916, all around the time of Lawrence of Arabia. And it's about a young boy and his older brother, and they've been orphaned, and they're taken in by their Bedouin tribe, and they get a visitor. It's a British officer, and he and his guide want to find a watering hole on the way to Mecca. And so Thebe's older brother is required, since he's the son of the late chief, he's required to help them. But of course, Thebe, who's about 8 or 9 years old, has to tag along, and they run into some trouble there. There's some raiders, there's some outcasts, some nomads with rifles, and it's a pretty intriguing adventure. So that's a pretty good one too.
Okay, Thebe, that's called. A couple of events going on at SLIFT this weekend. The event that I'll be hosting, and I've plugged this before, but I'm going to plug it again. This will be the last week I do that. It's the Tribute to Todd Browning, Friday night, November 13th, at Webster University's Winifred Moore Auditorium. That starts at 7:30. We're going to show a 35mm print of a silent film that Lon Chaney and Joan Crawford starred in 1927 called The Unknown. It's absolutely terrific, and that will be accompanied by music by the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra, who are just these super talented group of guys, and I think there's like 8 people in the orchestra, but they each play a couple instruments, so it sounds bigger. Then we will follow that up with Todd Browning's 1932 cult classic, Freaks.
Gooba gobble, gooba gobble.
We accept her, we accept her.
Gooba gobble, gooba gobble.
One of us, one of us.
Gooba
gobble.
they're going to make you one of them, my dear.
And I will be delivering a lecture about the life and career of Todd Browning that I hope isn't too boring.
Will this lecture be on the finals, Tom?
It will be. You'll all be tested on Todd Browning's career. Now, he had a very interesting career. He made 10 movies with Lon Chaney, and then, of course, he made Dracula in 1931, which is his most financial success. And then he made Freaks in 1932, which is his big financial failure, which sort of ruined his career. There's some myths about that, though, that I'll try to clear up Friday night in my talk.
I should say also that if you've never seen a film with a live orchestra, this is the perfect venue.
And The Unknown is like my favorite silent film of all time. It's a not-to-be-missed event. Also, this weekend, there's a filmmaker from Salt Lake City named Trent Harris, and he's coming as one of the guests of honor. Have you ever heard of this Beaver trilogy?
I have heard of that. Yeah. With Sean Penn's involved in it and Crispin Glover.
Well, basically what it is, he was working as a news cameraman in Beaver, Utah in like 1978, and he was hanging around in the parking lot testing out a new camera, and he saw this young man who was sort of seemed lost, and this kid was kind of a mess, so he just started filming him. This kid started doing all these imitations, known as the Beaver Kid, and then this kid said, follow me over to this talent show that I'm participating in tonight. So Trent Harris followed him to this talent show where this kid dressed in drag and sang Olivia Newton-John songs. And it ran about 30 minutes. It's very fascinating, though. But then a few years later, he decided to remake that. But he had it with an actor, and he hired Sean Penn, who wasn't very well known. I think he was filming Fast Times at Ridgemont High at the time. So he remade it with Sean Penn. So then a few years later, he remade it again with Crispin Glover. And then he stitched these three together, and it's called the Beaver Trilogy. And it's hard to describe, but it's actually quite fascinating. And then there'll be what they're calling Beaver Trilogy Part 4, which is a documentary about this kid, the Beaver Kid. And I haven't seen Beaver Trilogy Part 4, and that's not made by Trent Harris. That's made by another filmmaker who will be there with Trent Harris for this screening. Oh. That's interesting. Lots of interesting things coming up at the St. Louis International Film Festival. Look for lots of our reviews and interviews. We certainly cover the St. Louis International Film Festival far more than any other local outlet. So we're really just barely scratching the surface with the St. Louis International Film Festival. 450 films. Good grief. Go to cinemastlouis.org. And check out the scheduler or try to pick up one of these 100-plus page programs that are all over town and get out and see some independent, foreign documentaries, all kinds of films at the St. Louis International Film Festival. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is my favorite horror film.
This is the movie that is just as real, just as close.
Crazy! You gotta make us stop!
Just as terrifying as being there.
In fact, it's in my top five favorite movies of all time. It really sort of changed my life. I wanted to see every horror movie at the theater after I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974 when I was 12 years old. The star of that film, Gunnar Hansen, passed away.
He was the first Leatherface.
He was Leatherface, and I met him for the first time in 1989 at the very first horror movie convention I went to, which was a Fangoria weekend of horrors. You know, he's a nice guy. He never really had a career beyond that. He'd never played Leatherface in the many, many sequels, although they did give him a kind of a goofy cameo in that 3D chainsaw that we saw a couple of years ago. He made a couple of movies, Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers and Mosquito and things like that. He wasn't much of an actor, but he really did a pretty amazing job considering, you know, he's just wearing a mask. He didn't have any lines, but there was something about his physicality in that first Texas Chainsaw Massacre 40-plus years ago that was absolutely terrifying. He died. He was just 68 years old. I was kind of surprised. Apparently, he had pancreatic cancer. So rest in peace, Leatherface Gunnar Hansen. And someone else died the other day. It was Melissa Matheson, who was the screenwriter for E.P. Jim, why don't you talk a little bit about Ms. Matheson?
Well, Melissa is mostly known as a screenwriter. She sort of saw or was able to put on paper Steven Spielberg's vision, and that vision was E.T., the Extraterrestrial, which is the biggest hit film that she worked on for him. She also did the screenplays for The Black Stallion, The Indian in the Cupboard. I believe she was credited with one of the segments on the Twilight Zone movie. I believe it's the Kick the Cans segment. Kundan, the Martin Scorsese Dalai Lama film. And she even has one that's in production or post-production or pre-production right now, the BFG, I believe.
So
she was only 65. And she was at one time married to Harrison Ford
That's right. So rest in peace, Gunnar Hansen. Rest in peace, Melissa Matheson. Rest in peace, this show, because we're going to have to wrap it up. We'll be back next week. We'll have reviews of My All American and Spotlight and a couple of others. So for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
Listen again to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast next week.
Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.